What does it take to follow the science halfway around the world? How do you persuade a team of brilliant scientists to go from asking questions to building something? And why is, if you're explaining, you're losing, some of the worst biotech advice? Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. Today, I'm joined by Regan Jarvis, CEO of Anoka. Anoka is a T-cell biology biotech based near Stockholm, Sweden, and they're building a platform to decipher T-cell targets and targeting constructs to develop personalized and precise T-cell therapies. Of course, we'll talk more about the science at the end of the episode. Welcome to A Call to Lead, Regan. Thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here, Tim.
Regan, you began your research career in New Zealand, and if I can pronounce the Maori name correctly, Aotearoa, at the University of Otago. You're nodding, so I assume I got that right.
Yeah, dead right. Good job.
And then you made this huge trek from the other side of the planet to work at the DKFZ Cancer Research Center in Germany. Before obviously moving to Sweden, where you're now with Anoka, you started off as chief science officer, and now you sit in the CEO chair. So naturally, my first question for you is not just what inspired you to get into life science, but why did you move halfway around the world?
The inspiration around life sciences was I just, from an early age, loved biology. When I was, I think, still in intermediate school, we took a class field trip to the University of Otago. I think it was the microbiology department, actually, in to two of the labs and get a short lecture on immunology, look at the electron microscope and interacting with a dendritic cell under the electron microscope. So it was just like that ignited a spark and an interest. And then all through school, I love biology. Did really well in biology and not so well in the other classes, but I just paid attention more to biology. And then ended up specializing in biochemistry and doing a PhD there and some fundamental signal transduction research. And the trek over to Germany ultimately was just identifying a cool lab doing something I wanted to do at the DKFZ, right in my sort of PhD field. And then the step to Sweden was just another opportunity, seeing something cool to do and just grabbing the bull by the horns. And New Zealanders are prone to emigrate and travel around the world, but it seemed pretty natural.
You preach it to the choir. I'm Irish, we get around. Making that transition from deep scientific research, what was the motivation then for moving into the business world? I think you mentioned to me in our prep call as well, you had a colleague from New Zealand who was in Sweden already. Tell me about that story of that transition.
Yes, the colleague was Swedish and working in New Zealand, and he was my boss for my first postdoc. My fundamental background is signal transduction, nuts and bolts, sort of enzymology. And that first postdoc was in T-cell immunology, clinical immunology, looking at T-cell trafficking in inflamed mucosa, inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis. And Magnus, my former boss, moved back here to Sweden and called me up one day and said, hey, I met this cool investor, my now co-founder, Mikael Blomqvist, entrepreneur, investor, interested in biotech. Do you have an idea for a company? And I said, yeah, sure. I got an idea. Which was really born out of frustration working with T-cell immunology back in New Zealand for that first postdoc. So the motivation was, hey, there's going to be resource here after I sort of formed a business plan, presented a number of times to Mikael and colleagues, resource to do something really cool. So the motivation was scientific in the first, so it wasn't really about building a company. I was a fairly young man, postdoc, I'd say a bit naive and what could possibly go wrong kind of mentality. Just sounded cool, great opportunity, so jumped on it.
But that was you co-founding it as and coming on as chief science officer. After a few years, you stepped up to become CEO. So what was it about that moment that you decided this was the role for you, that you should be the leader?
It wasn't an intention. I didn't put my hand up and said, hey, I want to be a CEO and I lead the business, but it was a stage of the company where we'd done a lot of great fundamental work and it was starting to reach a scale where somebody needed to take the leadership, let's say by the horns more seriously than being that sort of initial startup, building tech, building systems. And it's seemed like the natural choice. And in certain ways, and I think this is true of biotech more and more these days, you're seeing more, let's say young, at least I was at the time, scientific founders, you know, taking on CEO roles because the complexity, for lack of a better word, of the industry and the technology that play are just so high that you need that sort of fundamental understanding about what your technology does and how to navigate your technology or whatever you're doing in the broader context, in product development, investor, raising money, partnering, and so on. So it's, I think what you're seeing more and more in the past 10, 12 years since I took on that role is more and more young founders, young scientific founders taking on that leadership role because it's kind of necessary. You need just that scientific, that technical understanding to execute on strategy, but also articulate the case that you're working with.
So in those early days as CEO, what was a real challenge that you faced and how did you overcome it?
Yeah, let's say other than the very long hours and the strain on relationships, personal relationships, I think that was, is a challenge faced by lots of leaders in biotech. It's just long hours, long, high levels of engagement. It's just tough work. I think specifically as a leader at the company, I think it was really getting myself and the team to focus on execution. To be honest, we were the founding team were all pretty young scientists coming out of postdocs. You gathered a very, very talented team early on. And trying not to get basically distracted by fundamental science, you're trying to gain mechanistic understanding, but really trying to impart this applied science focus, saying, hey, we're going to have to kill some great ideas. We're going to have to put them on the shelf in the interest of executing on what we're trying to build. And trying to control those scientific urges, those scientific instincts was challenging for me personally, but also for the organization, and trying to impart that sort of applied science thinking. And I've said for a long time now that basically the differentiation is academic labs, by and large, ask questions. But that's what their job is. Biotech labs build stuff, and really trying to impart that mentality. Hey, we're building X technology, this system to build these products. And that's sort of, I think, a huge challenge for me and us as a team early on.
Yeah.
And I think that's often a challenge to basically resist the scientific impulse and focus on execution.
It sounds like you had that real academic researcher mentality baked into the culture just by virtue of who the founding team were. So how did you redirect them towards the biotech mentality?
I mean, a lot of conversation, right? And a lot of, hey, we're just not doing that. We're doing this instead. I mean, and some of that was tough. Like I said, personally, the urges to do the cool science rather than to execute on applied science, sort of a system build or technology build. But it's, everyone basically understood the idea and that we're a company, we have to build stuff in order to be able to build products that we can ultimately market or partner for revenues as a biotech. So it wasn't painful. They weren't hard discussions. It was just a lot of reinforcement. Hey, we're going down a rabbit hole, even in discussion. We don't want to see this lab work done because resource and time is better spent elsewhere. So I wouldn't say it wasn't personally tough. There wasn't confrontation. It was just constant reinforcement and sort of, making sure people were on task and focused on what we're trying to achieve.
And looking across your peers, other CEOs in the space, what do you see as the big challenges, especially for fellow scientific founders like yourself? What challenges are they facing today?
Yeah, I mean, I think focus is a big one. A lot of the teams I know are early on. It's about, hey, what can we build now? How do we get POC preclinically? How do we demonstrate our technology works to customers or partners? I think that's a huge one. Articulating that case, differentiation, USP, whatever is a big one too. Other than the, like I referred to it, the big workload and the personal challenge. Yeah. I think that's a fundamental company challenge when you're starting up. I think sometimes as well as young founders, you're not a professor with a very deep academic track record. You don't have a, you know, personally, I don't have a big publication base background to point to as a point of credibility. So you have to lean into how you communicate, what you're communicating to build the credibility and show that you can set up milestones as a company and keep achieving those milestones and make sure people are watching you achieve those milestones. I think that's kind of sort of in essence what you have to do early on and keep doing is set up how you're going to progress and demonstrate that progress. Yeah, and whatever dimension that is for your company.
I think that point of communication is certainly a critical one for scientific founders. And you gave me a really nice quote when we spoke earlier, and you used the phrase, let's embrace complexity. Tell me more about what your thinking is there and why we should.
Yeah, it comes back to communication. How do you articulate differentiation? How do you explain your technology? You know, fundamentally, what's the business opportunity and how you present that to investors or potential partners, particularly, like you say, for platform companies? And the bottom line is complexity of science in general across any field is getting bigger. You know, there's bigger science, there's a deeper technology stack that you have to apply, and therefore a deeper expertise stack behind those technologies. And with a lens on our particular field of T-cell biology, is it's not broadly well understood. It's a bit mysterious. There's a lot of misconceptions. And you know, I was told many times over the years, if you're explaining, you're losing. Simplify the message. And I really don't think that's true, at least not anymore. I think you need to address this activation energy in your field so people can understand your USP, your differentiation, and ultimately what your investment or partnering case is to your counterparty. So that's what I mean by, hey, embrace the complexity. Science is complex. The field is getting more complex. Explain where you're operating, how you're operating, and what your differentiation is. That's a huge challenge. For us as a company, our technology is all about acknowledging the complexity and systemizing that so we can scale the analysis and development of targeted T-cell therapies more generally. We're not the only ones operating in a complex scientific space. I mean, it's biotech, it's medtech, increasing use of machine learning, AI, and so on and so forth. And it's, yeah, the sophistication of science is there. So you just need to explain that and contextualize what you're doing. I mean, whether it's new modalities, new analytical platforms, new therapeutic targets, new manufacturing tech, new clinical designs, new biomarkers. It's all so damn complex these days. You need to be able to integrate that message and communicate that clearly. I think that's, again, a massive challenge for, you know, technical founders, platform companies. But I think it's true across biotech, medtech. Be clear about what you're doing and why.
I completely agree. And you mentioned you got this almost, I guess, bad bit of advice if you're explaining you're losing. But let's talk about good advice for a second. I think you've been very serendipitous in that you've had a former leader in a lab reach out to you and bring you in on this project. You've had someone who wanted to build a company and you've had a team around you. So I'd love to know, was there a valuable lesson that you learned from one of your peers or one of your colleagues that you could never have learned through formal education on your leadership journey?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I never could learn it. Might have been a maturity thing, but what springs to mind is advice I got from our now chairman, who's an immensely experienced guy across industry, Hans Strauberg. And it was about how basically I was communicating differentiation. Yeah, and I'm a scientist at heart. Like I said, I love to challenge ideas and engage in debate and dialectic. And that kind of manifested in me when presenting our technology and our approach against competing technologies and modalities as being a bit negative, like pointing out what the weaknesses of our competitors were. And so the early advice that Hans gave me was basically speak to strengths and be positive. Refer to your peers as peers, not competitors. You know, say what things they're doing well and why that's good, and then compare and contrast what you're doing. And you know, I think it was an absolutely stellar piece of advice. It changes the tone of the discussion. You never know who you're going to offend if you're saying, hey, these are all negative. But more importantly, hey, it's a scientific field we're operating in, and it should be acknowledging good work where it's done, and then compare and contrast. It's not about knocking competitors and peers down. It's about lifting you up and showing your differentiation. A great piece of advice, and I think perhaps would have come with a bit of maturity. Like I said, this was pretty naive, kind of a young guy, and maybe a bit aggressive, a bit scientific around it. But I think that's an important lesson I've taken from basically the governance structure at Anoka. And there's lots of examples as well, where just sort of subtle redirects from a very experienced board, but also internally, like tone and communication, I think is always a good thing, from a leadership perspective.
How would you say your tone has changed since becoming a leader? There's a little smirk on your face right now as well, so I know this is a good answer.
Well, good question. Yeah, I think the tone is perhaps more, I don't want to say empathetic, it's softer, right? I mean, you grow on a team, you're trying to bring people along for the journey. It's less about, we're going to do this now my way or the highway. It's like, how do we do this as a team? That comes with experience, I guess, and maturity. But yeah, I think good leaders are good at articulating a vision and sticking to that vision, whether it's a big grand strategy or it's a vision about this particular thing we're doing. But yeah, it's about, rather than saying this is what we're doing and this is how we're doing it, it's more, let's do this together type of tone. I think that, and again, maturity, experience that you require to have that kind of outlook. Some people are naturally good at it. Perhaps I wasn't. It's just a reflection.
It's good that you've had your chair and you've had some, as you say, subtle redirects from people in the team to be able to help you grow on that journey as well. And I think that's a good point to come back to that you mentioned, that you never know when a competitor might become a partner further down the line. Companies pivot all the time.
Mm. Yeah, and like I say, I mean, it's a pretty broad community, but it's pretty small in terms of personality. There's a lot of overlap in technology and so on. And like I say, as a young guy, perhaps being a bit negative on competitors / peers, but I think it's important to bring everyone along for the journey and give credit where credit's due. There's a lot of smart people, a lot of great technology. It's just not always apt for the areas that you're operating in. I think that's horses for courses kind of thinking. A lot of great tech, a lot of great application areas, but what you are trying to achieve, how does your tech lift up that objective? How does it progress the field or the modality, whatever you're working with?
Yeah. That mentality of a rising tide raises all boats.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in our space, feeling very small community of TCRT companies we want to see everyone do well, and we want to see people execute more clinical programs with more positive data. That benefits everyone in this pretty niche indication to me.
And speaking of small friendly communities, and I'm not talking about life science org for once, you moved from New Zealand to Europe. So I would love to know your almost outsider perspective of what makes European science a little bit unique, or what makes it a special place to do research and build companies?
On the research side of things, compared to New Zealand, it's just a completely different scale, right? There's so many high quality institutions, lots of fabulous research, lots of funding, lots of good infrastructure for the R&D as well. National labs, core facilities, European level labs, and so on. So it's just, there's a lot of activity, therefore a lot of talent in the system. Incredible science being done. I think people often point at the European ecosystem. They say, hey, there's not enough capital to really grow biotech and to scale companies in the ecosystem. I think that certainly is partly true when you're looking, say at the US, where there's just a much deeper pool of capital. I think there's a different mentality of how that capital is allocated early on as well. The ecosystem here is perhaps a little bit too academic early in biotech, sort of founding of all medtech companies, but also just the way you build companies here in Europe is just fundamentally different from the US. And that's, I always compare to the US, of course, rather than New Zealand, as an outsider observing the industry. But I think the fundamental difference there is how you build teams and how rapidly you could scale teams in Europe versus US. And I'm not speaking negatively about employment law in Europe, because I think it has a lot of positives, but it just means you can't hire and fire as aggressively as you can in the US. You can, you know, grow a team rapidly, trim non-performers, right-size your organization across different phases of development, which is just extremely difficult to do here in the EU and can be very costly and encumber sort of the pace of development as well. So I think that's, you know, capital aside, which is talked about often, I think just the way you build teams because of employment law here in Europe is just, it's kind of constraining about how you allocate capital, how you grow teams rapidly. But it's something you have to navigate. On the flip side, there's a lot of dedicated talent. You know, our founding science team, still on board 12 years later, our nucleus of sort of senior scientists who, you know, manage the R&D and the manufacturing development, and even at manufacturing execution, been on board 8-9+ years. So a very strong, dedicated nucleus, which is the flip side of that employment. You're thinking you've got a long-term team in place rather than perhaps losing staff, the key staff, to competitors like you would in the big hubs in the US, for example.
Yeah. Would you do it all again here if you could do it all again?
I think I would. Yeah, Europe, like I said, there's so much talent. In Sweden in particular, there's a lot of biotech companies with not many of scale. So we get the pick of the postdocs, PhD, master's graduates out of the local institutions, basically. So yeah, it's a great source of talent. And like all companies, it's cliche, but you know, your success is built on the people. Access to people and the continuity of, let's say, supply of talent is just so good here in Europe, and particularly here in Sweden.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about Sweden is that it's a great ecosystem in its own right for life science, and they've got FICA, which you won't find anywhere else.
That's true. FICA, multiple times a day. So to explain what David's talking about, it's coffee and sweets. It's afternoon tea, morning tea kind of thinking. Institutionalized.
That's it. It's crucial for team building. There's no siloization because of FICA.
No, it's it builds collaboration, that's for sure.
As a leader, Regan, you chose to look at T-cell biology. You have been steeped in it for much of your academic career. Tell me about the challenge, what it means for patients, for researchers in this space, and why you're choosing to lead it.
So T-cell biology, like I said, it's complex. It's a bit misunderstood. Yeah, T cells are at the center of a huge amount of human disease. Your T cells are responsible for fighting cancer, infectious disease. When it goes wrong, it causes autoimmunity, it causes allergy. It's responsible for transplant rejection, for example. Basically, that's a majority of human disease. My research background, like I said earlier, was enzymology, signal transduction biochemistry. And that first postdoc working with the clinical immunology and T cells, we did some very cool work, but it was that frustration. We just couldn't break down the specificity. You know, what are the targets? What are the targeting receptors and the T cell receptors responsible for that targeting? And so there was this realization that, hey, we have to be able to decipher that complexity, that HLA peptide target biology and the TCR targeting biology. And just to paint that challenge, right? So these HLA peptide targets, there are thousands of HLAs, human leukocyte antigens, human population. It's the most polymorphic gene locus in all vertebrate animals. And each of those is able to present a different peptide target, which is the actual unique target that T cells recognize. And that's a massive diversity. So over 9 to the 20, over a sextillion possible peptides.
Wow.
And the T cell system deals with that target diversity to be able to recognize something it's never seen before by having this incredible T cell receptor, this targeting receptor diversity, which it looks like that VDJ recombination of an antibody builds a random receptor. There's over 10 to the 18 possible combinations in each human, so what, a quintillion. So there's this massive biological diversity, this genetic diversity you have to overcome to identify targets and targeting receptors and do anything specific here. And that numerical complexity is even more challenging when you consider, hey, this is wrapped in two cell biology systems. The target cells, let's say a diseased tumor cell or infected cell, is processing proteins into peptides in the cytosol, transporting it to the endoplasmic reticulum, trimming those peptides, chaperoning them into an HLA complex and giving them to the cell surface. It's this incredibly complex cell biology process. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, a T cell with its unique TCR is sampling that at the cell surface by engaging. When it recognizes sort of a synapse is forming, the sort of a signaling reinforcement, which drives the exquisite sensitivity of T cells, feedback, feedforward, and hundreds of proteins involved in these dynamic cell processes. So you have to deal with this genetic diversity in the context of the cell biology. It's not a biochemistry game like antibody sticks to ligand. It's a cell communicate with cell. So our core innovation is basically analytical in nature. We built a range of molecular genetic cell biology technologies to basically systemize and standardize cell-based assays. So we can look at target presentation, map HLA peptide targets, and build collections of TCRs and very deeply characterize those and even optimize them with directed evolution as the defining feature of a targeted T-cell therapy. So we focus today on TCR T-cell therapies, TCR-modified T-cell therapies. You can think of it like a CAR-T, which is more broadly understood, but with the natural targeting mechanism and as a corollary, much more specific targeting mechanism to open up targets across disease areas, but in a case, across tumor forms and genetic backgrounds. The caveat to that is not only do you need to decipher that complexity, you need to do it again and again and again in a scalable and ideally cost-effective manner. And that's really what our technology platform, our discovery engine is all about, is systemized, scalable, cost-effective mapping of targets, building constructs. And what that means to patients is that by providing the correct target and a very optimal targeting receptor, you can deliver very potent therapeutics. These are T cells equipped to recognize and execute a cancer cell in the oncology context. And also that there can be, if you do it right, exquisitely specific. So that reduces the off-target toxicity effect. So the opportunity is to drive extremely potent, extremely safe therapeutics by necessity personalized to patient disease and genetic background. And so we've operationalized this primarily in cancer, building a very deep TCR T cell therapy pipeline, built our own manufacturing capability in-house, deployed a first clinical program here in Europe. Again, bigger picture, this fundamental HLA peptide target TCR biology is at the center of oncology, infectious disease, autoimmunity, allergy transplant rejection. So the fundamental barrier to doing anything specific interventionally, prophylactically in all those settings is understanding those targets and those targeting receptors and being able to either provide a TCR for cell therapy or, I think more commonly in future, a vaccine or a tolerizing therapeutic that can specifically leverage disease targets. So we see our technology, our approach, as being sort of a fundamental barrier to entry. You can identify, validate disease targets, and you can provide these targeting constructs for personalized therapies. And I strongly think that T cell biology is at the center of personalized precision medicine moving forward. That's where the targets are. You need to be able to decipher the targets and provide targeting constructs. And that's the founding concept behind the company. We want to build the analytical capability to do that. And sort of downstream of this, you need to make products out of that information. But we think and thought and still think the fundamental barrier to entry is mapping a target, building constructs. In the meantime, the last 12 years, hundreds of billions of dollars gone into manufacturing technologies. There's a wealth of ways to manufacture cell therapies, vaccines, gene therapies. What we need is as a field, as an industry, is more novel targets, more novel targeting constructs. And I strongly think that a lot of that comes from T-cell biology.
I think you've kind of stepped into the next question I was about to ask you, which is what can we in the ecosystem, the researchers, networks, regulators, investors, what can we all do that helps realize this goal?
But it goes back to that soundbite you called out earlier, that if it was embracing the complexity. Right. I mean, the description I just gave was an extremely complex piece of biology contextualized across different modalities, disease areas. And I think as a research community, we're getting there. We're understanding the opportunity and what we need to do to sort of break down the problem and systemize product development. I think the regulators are getting there as well. to be honest. I mean, they're recognizing sort of the outsized impact cell therapies can bring, and potentially vaccines and gene therapies in general. And they're putting in place, you know, frameworks, both manufacturing and regulatory frameworks, which are acknowledging sort of the personalized, relatively small patient cohort nature of this development. I think investors are getting there too. Again, they're understanding there is an outsized impact. There was a big wave of investment in T-cell therapies, primarily CAR-Ts, over the past decade. But we still just need to keep acknowledging that complexity and acknowledging that there are a number of things to smooth out, right? Not just in what we specialize in, the discovery aspect, but the manufacturing, the clinical development, the regulatory frameworks and commercialization, so on, reimbursement even. But you know, look, this is analogous to how antibody therapeutics evolved early on, right? There was deep skepticism about the modality, even in the 90s, eye-wateringly expensive to manufacture. And that scale and sort of cost-effectiveness took decades to smooth out, right? From, was it 96 was the first antibody product approved?
Yeah, it's
probably mid-teens into a really scalable, comfortable to make any antibody you want, basically. And that's now the backbone of, you know, high-value therapeutic products, right, antibody. So you have to realize that first ever approved targeted cell therapy, 2017, less than 10 years ago. So we're early in this journey. A lot of investment in this manufacturing technology. We need more novel targets and therapeutic targets, more novel targeting constructs to scale manufacturing technologies. We can't keep doing more CD19 BCMA CAR-Ts, which is still the mainstay of the field. You need novel targets, novel products to scale, you know, these novel technologies into clinical trials and, of course, commercialization. So there's a lot of moving pieces there, but it's acknowledging and embracing the complexity of the field. You're not going to do this by distilling it to a magic bullet. There's just a lot of things required to fall into place and a lot of diligence, not just from companies and researchers, but regulators and investors to bring this to the forefront.
Regan, thank you so much for your time and talking with me on A Call to Lead, but I always have my secret last question, which shouldn't be a secret by now. We've done 2 seasons of this podcast. But the last question I like to ask, which is there anything on the topic of leadership that we haven't discussed that you'd like to talk about in your final few minutes?
I'm aware of the secret question, David, so I haven't been thought about it. But maybe it's just sort of delineating the way I think about management versus leadership, right? Because they are, in essence, different things. And management is communication, organization, structuring people's work, keeping people up to date and informed about tasks and their priorities. Rather technical. And there's a big element of listening and feedback collection there, but it's really about execution and mainly about communicating to people and to teams, right? That's the core objective. Leadership is a step up from that in a way. It's about keeping people informed on a broader vision at a strategic level. And it doesn't need to be grand strategy of a company. It can be, you know, specific. We have a vision to execute this process, this organizational build. A very large part of that leadership is understanding people and really listening to people, understanding their capabilities, their interests, listen to their personal and professional priorities, even guiding them towards execution, setting that inside how it progresses their own careers sometimes, giving them advice in that area. So management is this more structured sort of day-to-day communication process, whereas leadership is this more structured listening, motivating and building up people in the team, right? And I think it's important to recognize that there's a difference because, you know, execution is great, management is great, organization's great, but you also need to motivate people and bring them along for the journey. Yeah, we've got an amazing team. We've got 130 odd people based here near Stockholm, 45 nationalities represented. So incredible diversity of educational background, diversity of expertise, and diversity of opinion. That's so leadership is getting all of those ducks in a row and focusing everyone and motivating all that talent to pull in the right direction. I think leadership is that strategic vision. Management is execution. I think conflating the two can be challenging just from a a focus point of view as a leader or a manager. So that's how I think about personally how I try and help people out in the organization to guide execution and motivation.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that you've had some of that early team have been there, what, 12, 13 years, and your manufacturing team 8 or 9 years. That's a testament, I think, to the leader's ability to motivate.
Yeah, and that's across the organization. It's a pretty diverse group to manage, but it's a great team spirit. We put a focus on collaboration. Fika helps that, as you say, David. Bring people together around a cup of coffee and a sweet, build a bit of team spirit. We're doing cool stuff. It's high technology. People are motivated to make therapeutics very high up need indications. So it's kind of a privileged position as a company leader.
Wonderful. Regan, thank you so much again for joining me. Thank you for sharing your learnings, your challenges, your experiences. And I think now I'm going to go for coffee and a cinnamon bun.
Sounds like a good plan. Thanks for having me. Great to speak to you. It was good fun.
It's no secret that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions inspire us every week. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our life science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.